why I'm calling that here shortly, okay? So in lesson 193, we consider the following 3 points regarding the preface, the translators to the reader, found in the preliminary material of the AV of 1611. We talked about, first, about access. We looked at how the preface had been removed from modern printings of the AV in the 1800s into the 1900s, and so one of the problems was access. It was not being published. By the way, on that point, I do have a few old Bibles, and I have a 1920 at home, American Bible Society printing, and I just looked at it yesterday. I thought about bringing it in, but it's in not very good shape. It's falling apart quite badly, so I didn't want to transport it if I didn't have to. But there is no preface in the front of it. So the American Bible Society editions were not including the preface, at least not the one that I had. It was a small one, pocket size, the kind of size that you would think maybe would have been carried overseas. I've often wondered maybe if that Bible didn't end up in Europe during World War I or something, or World War II. But anyway, that's just neither here nor there as far as what we're talking about. When we talk about access, last lesson we talked about the structure of the preface, how the preface is structured and put together, and then we talked about the style of the writing, the style of the language that is found in the preface compared to the biblical text of the 1611. So those were the 3 points that we talked about last Sunday as we really kind of began studying the preface in earnest. Okay? In doing so, we observed the content of the 11-page preface is broken down into 15 subsections. And in this lesson, we'll begin a consideration of the contents of the preface by looking at each subsection. Okay? Now, what I've done for structure is I've broken out. We're going to take them all in order, all 15 of them. And the first three are about slander and how things are slandered. And so I took those three first. And we're going to talk then about what I'm calling the slander sections, right? So the first three subsections are related to the issue of I'm going to say this wrong, Mike. How do you say it?
Calumniate.
Calumniate or slander, and our title as follows. So the first subsection is the best things have been calumniated. And that's a word that means, I have it in brackets there, a word that means false and defamatory statements about, or i.e. slander. Okay? Then it says, the second subsection is the highest personages have been calumniated. Still saying it wrong, probably. And the third subsection is His Majesty's constancy, notwithstanding calumniation or slander, from the survey of the English translations. So the first three subsections are related to slander, all right? That's why I'm calling them the slander sections, and I'm probably not going to keep saying the word that I can't say. I'm just going to substitute in slander because, and you'll understand if you have the notes and are, you know, tuned into what's going on here, okay? So given that these three subsections are about the same general subject matter, we will discuss their contents together as a unit. Now, before moving forward, it's important to understand the format that we are adopting for studying the preface. Each subsection, the title of which will be centered, justified, and bolded, we'll present the text of the preface in a table with a modern spelling transcription on the left, and the modern form presented by Drs. Earl F. Rhodes and Lina Lupus in The Translators to the Reader, the original preface of the King James Version of 1611, revisited on the right. So if you just briefly look at the next page, let me just talk about this before we move on. So on the left, you see the modern spelling transcription. And then on the right column, you have the modern form edited by Rhodes and Lupus. All right? So, I mentioned this book to you last week. I want to say something about it again. The Translators to the Reader, the original preface to the King James Version of 1611 Revisited, is sort of the work that you're going to want to pick up if you're interested in studying this for yourself. The preface is presented in three different formats in this book. The first format is a facsimile of the way it appeared actually in a 1611. The second format is a what they're calling, and I've sort of borrowed their terms, even though I'm not following exactly what their format, but what they're calling a transcription. So all it is basically the same language, just updated in its spelling, and the marginal notes have been put at the bottom of the page in footnotes, okay? And then the last form, the third and final form that they present this in, is a modern form of language to make it slightly easier to read, as far as following with what is being said in the preface, okay? So what I've done, I have an online copy that has simply updated the spelling. So that's what I'm calling here a modern spelling transcription. The form is the same, the sentence structure is the same, I've tried to keep all the italicized stuff the same, it's simply just a modern spelling, okay? Then on this side is the modern form that is edited by Rhodes and Lupus that I got from their book, which I'm certainly giving them credit for and citing appropriately, okay? So you have two columns, modern transcription on the left, modern form on the right, okay? Let's go back to the notes on bottom of page one. So after about midway through that paragraph, the transcription on the left seeks to retain the original formatting of the preface as much as possible, including italicizing quotations and allusions to the biblical text. Brackets with scripture references have been added to the transcription to help readers easily identify the scripture passages Miles Smith was using to support his arguments. To be clear, the modern spelling transcription retains all the original wording and sentence structure of the preface. The only changes that have been made are updates in the spelling and the adding of the brackets clearly identifying the scriptural references that Smith is using to make his points. Those interested in viewing the preface in its original format can do so by clicking on this link. So that'll be a live link on the internet, okay? Within each table, the individual paragraphs of the preface will be numbered. Beneath each table, we will provide any necessary commentary or elucidation of the subsection in question. So that's the general structure, okay? I'm going to present it to you in two formats. Underneath, I've numbered every paragraph, will be numbered. And then at the bottom, after each table where I present the text in these two formats, we'll talk about it, okay? Now, what I think we're going to do, okay, is we're going to read the modern format, not the modern transcription. It will just be, all we're after here is a sense of what this subsection is about. And I think that is easiest achieved by just following the right-hand column, okay? Again, I'm not trying to misrepresent anything. I'm not trying any smoke and mirrors here. I'm giving it to you right next to it in the other format. And I think you'll see, if you compare this, that there are not substantive idea changes. It's just simply an easier format to understand what is being said, okay? So let's start with paragraph one then on the right. Under the modern form edited by Rhodes and Lupus. Paragraph 1. Any effort to promote the common good, whether by creating something ourselves or by adapting the work of others, surely deserves serious respect and consideration. Yet it finds only a cold reception in the world. It is greeted with suspicion instead of interest, with disparagement instead of gratitude. And if there is any room left for quibbling, and quibblers will invent a pretext, if they do not find one, it is sure to be misinterpreted and risk being condemned. Anyone who has any experience or familiarity with history will readily admit this. For was anything ever undertaken with a touch of newness or improvement about it that did not run into storms of argument or opposition? Anyone would think that orderly government, sound laws, education, councils, and church support, not to mention other such things, should be as safe as a sanctuary and beyond the range, as they say, of anyone's carping or any dog's yapping. Okay? By orderly government, we are distinguished from animals which follow their appetites. By sound laws, we are controlled and restrained from disgusting behavior and from injuring others, whether by fraud or by violence. By education, we are enabled to enlighten and help others by the insight and understanding that we ourselves have gained. Further, by councils, we have come together in direct negotiations to settle our differences more quickly than by writings, which can be interminable. Finally, giving adequate support to the church is reasonable and appropriate, just as mothers are considered less cruel who kill their children as soon as they are born than the nursing fathers and mothers, whether they are, who keep from their babies at their breast the support that they need, and whom also depend on them for the spiritual and pure milk of the word. So it is obvious that the things we are speaking of are basic necessities, and therefore no one can dispute them without being absurd or object to them without note of wickedness. Go to page 3, you'll see paragraph 2. So let's just stop right there, okay? So what Smith is identifying is the fact that anything new is going to be slandered. And he identifies different categories that distinguish us from brute beasts, and he's talking about why this is an important undertaking that they're engaged in here when it comes to the Bible. If you go to page 3, let's follow paragraph 2. Again, marked for you clearly. Yet despite this, so despite everything he just said, scholars know that honorable men have been condemned to death for attempting to bring good order and discipline to their countrymen, and that in some states it was made a capital crime even to propose a new law, abrogating an old, even though the old law was pernicious. So he's talking from history here, okay? And he's saying, people who know history know that humans have behaved in these ways. Essentially is what he's saying. And that some leaders who were regarded as pillars of state and models of virtue and prudence had been very reluctant to accept common standards of good letters and refined speech, shying away from them as from rocks or from poison. And fourthly, it was not a rash youth, but a reputable scholar who stated, perhaps in passion, but yet clearly in writing, which remains to posterity, that he had never seen anything good come from a council or meeting of the clergy, but rather the opposite. And finally, with regard to the church support and the subsidies that are provided for the ambassadors and messengers of the great King of Kings, there is the story, or rather the fable, as our source called it, that when the professors of the and teachers of Christianity in the Church of Rome, notice the qualification, when it was a true church, so that tells you Smith is saying he views the Roman church at the time of this writing as a non-legitimate what? Church, okay? Were generously endowed, a voice was heard from heaven saying, now poison has been poured into the church. Thus not only whenever we say something, but also whenever we do anything of note or consequence, we lay ourselves open to everyone's criticism, and they are fortunate who are least subjected to idle gossip, because it is impossible to escape it altogether. Anyone is deceived who imagines that it is true of only, now watch, of only unimportant people, and that princes are privileged by their position. So in other words, if you are of a high position, are you immune from this idle gossip and chatter? Smith's saying what?
No.
No. Okay? Quote, We never know who will be killed in war, as it says in 2 Samuel, and as it says in Samuel, and then they have the parentheses there, that's the reference. A great commander once charged his forces entering a battle to aim only at the faces of the enemy, and the Syrian king commanded his captains to attack no one but the king of Israel. And it is true that envy strikes most cruelly at the fairest and best. David was a worthy prince, outstanding among his peers for his early deeds, and yet for the worthiest act of his life, bringing back the Ark of God in solemn triumph, he was despised and scoffed at by his own wife. Solomon was greater than David, not in virtue, but in power. By his power and wisdom, built a temple to the Lord that was the glory of the land of Israel and the wonder of the whole world. But was this magnificent achievement appreciated by everyone? Hardly. Otherwise, why do they blame the son and appeal to him to ease the burden, saying, "Lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke that he has placed on us"? Evidently, he oppressed them with conscripted labor and burdened them with taxes that they reacted disastrously, wishing in their heart that the temple had never been built. It is so difficult to please everyone, even when we please God best, to try to commend ourselves to everyone's conscience. So those are the first two paragraphs of the preface, subsection 1, dealing with the general, and remember the title of that, let's just go back and check that. Remember this is the best things have been calumated, okay? Now, if you range with Smith, he covers a lot of different things to support the argument that he's making. So let's look at bullet point page 4. In the first paragraph, Miles Smith sets forth the general principle that, quote, new things, whether they be original or revisions of prior work, are likely to be met with, quote, emulation instead of thanks, and are, quote, sure to be misconstrued and in danger to be condemned. Smith asks whether there has ever been a new undertaking that was not, quote, endured, that has not, quote, endured many a storm of gainsaying or opposition. According to Smith, quote, civility, wholesome laws, learning and eloquence, synods, and church maintenance should be, quote, as safe as a sanctuary from those who would, quote, lift up the heel, no, nor dog move his tongue against the motioners of them. So let's just stop there. You will notice that in the paragraph I'm quoting from the transcription, not from the modern form, okay, unless it's marked, okay? It is by orderly government and sound laws that humans, quote, are controlled and restrained from disgusting behavior and from injuring of others, whether by fraud or by violence. And that line was from Rhodes and Lupus. After discussing the role of education and councils in settling disputes, Smith turns his attention to the role of the church in establishing societal order. Next, by way of illustration, Smith compares the cruelty of those who, quote, kill their children as soon as they are born, and those, quote, nursing fathers and mothers who keep from their babies at their breasts the support they need, and who depend on them for the spiritual milk of the word, thus establishing a comparison with the work of the translators. So in other words, are the translators providing to the English-speaking world the pure milk of the word through their translation? Okay? Therefore, it is at the risk of, quote, absurdity or wickedness that someone would speak against the necessary work that Smith is speaking of, i.e., the translation he is presenting to the reader. Okay? Now, let's stop there. Anybody got any questions about the meaning and intent of the first paragraph? We good? Okay. In the second paragraph, Smith builds upon the reasoning from set forth in paragraph 1. Despite the absurdity and wickedness Despite the absurdity and wickedness so speaking against such a work, quote, the learned know that certain worthy men have been brought to untimely death for no other fault but for seeking to reduce their countrymen to good order and discipline. These factors have led, quote, some leaders who are regarded as pillars of the Senate and models of virtue and prudence who have been reluctant to accept common standards of good letters and refined speech, shying away from them as rocks or from poison. Smith argues that this negative thinking, it extends into things pertaining to the church, so much so that, quote, as oft as we do anything of note or consequence, we subject ourselves to everyone's censure, and happy is he that is least tossed upon tongues, for utterly to escape the snatch of them is impossible. People who think, quote, that this is the lot and portion of the meaner sort only, and that princes are privileged by their estate, are deceived, according to Smith. Next, Smith cites 2 Samuel 11:25, 1 Kings 22:31, in support of the statement, quote, so it is true that envy striketh most spitefully at the fairest and chiefest. Smith then uses David, scorned and scoffed by his own wife, 2 Samuel 6:16, and Solomon, 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 4, being derided for the temple as scriptural examples of for the final sentence of the paragraph, quote, so hard a thing it is to please all, even when we please God best, and do seek to approve ourselves to everyone's conscience. So Smith is making an argument here.